due to the pollution in terms of this oxygen dead zone that I've talked about, but also the fact that vessels engaging in illegal fishing sometimes discard their nets to avoid detection. It obviously undermines the sustainability of the ocean environment in those ways through pollution.
The European Union has fishing agreements with individual African nations for legal fishing rights. However, even where the EU pays a set amount annually to the host country for fishing rights, the amount paid is peanuts compared to the value of the fish.
Now, these agreements are questionable because they promote the export of African marine resources into the EU to the detriment of local economies and food security. European governments are clearly aware of companies in their countries that are engaged in unsustainable fishing to satisfy Europe's appetite for fish. Now, why have they failed to take action to stop these acts of impunity?
It's really baffling, because the reality is that, I mean, in recent time, there's this global conversation around putting an end to harmful subsidy, because this is a subsidy that allows or enables distant water fishing vessels to go to third countries or countries like those in West Africa to exploit species, either targeting already overexploited species legally or engaging in illegal fishing. I mean, and not stopping or putting an end to these subsidies, which obviously mean that for them, it's more or less about their own respective national interests than ensuring the sustainability of the marine resources or even the livelihood of the countries where these illegal acts are affected.
Very unfortunate indeed that greed by rich industrialized countries is leading to increased levels of poverty in these West African countries. As we have seen there, illegal and unregulated fishing in West Africa is a major challenge in the region, threatening livelihoods, nutritional security, export revenues, and destroying the environment.
Addressing the 10th Conference of Ministers and the 10th anniversary of the Fisheries Committee for the West Central Gulf of Guinea in 2017, Nigerian Vice President Professor Yemi Osinbajo outlined some of his government's plans aimed at stopping illegal and unregulated fishing.
To this end, President Buhari has approved the purchase of some vessels for the Department of Fisheries, some patrol vessels for the Department of Fisheries, which will be managed in collaboration with the Nigerian Navy. These vessels will boost the search and rescue capacities of the relevant security agencies, deter illegal fishing, prevent illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing, and help secure our vessels at sea.
Now, our last question, Dr. Okafor-Yarud. What needs to be done to safeguard the West African waters?
What needs to be done is for African countries to actually work together. An example of how countries or regions can collaborate or cooperate around fisheries agreement, for instance, should they decide to go that route, is something that Pacific island nations have, where they negotiate these agreements as a bloc. In the context of West Africa, we already have the Economic Community of West African States. So perhaps they can come together as a bloc as well and negotiate fisheries agreements in a way that if they decide to continue with this approach as a way of economic development, they are then better able to ensure that they negotiate better deal as a bloc, and also ensure that the interests of the communities where the species are extracted from is protected. And by this, I also mean that there is need for better transparency around this agreement.
Well, Dr. Okafor-Yarud there says that unity of African countries and transparency is key to stopping illegal and unregulated fishing that is impacting negatively on communities. Now, what's your opinion? Let's know what you think through our social media handle. Well, our time is up for today. On behalf of my colleagues here at Africa Today, it's goodbye for now.
Insightful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Human Rights Watch, HRW, has released a report accusing the Zionist regime of the crime of apartheid. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Yumna Patel Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Human Rights Watch finds Israeli regime guilty of crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Human Rights Watch, HRW, has released a report accusing the Zionist regime of the crime of apartheid. The 213-page report, entitled A Threshold Crossed, Israeli Regime Authorities and the Crimes of Apartheid and Persecution, found that the Zionist regime is responsible for committing crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution in the entire territory under its control, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. Echoing the findings of leading Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which released its own report accusing the fake regime of Israel of apartheid earlier this year, the HRW report claims that through discriminatory policies that methodically privilege Israeli Jews over Palestinians under the state's control, Human Rights Watch concludes that the Zionist regime has demonstrated an intent to maintain the domination of Jewish Israelis over Palestinians across the occupied Palestine and the OPT, the group said. While the term apartheid was coined in reference to the system of institutionalized racial segregation that existed in South Africa up until 1990s, the HRW report defines the fake regime of Israel apartheid along the lines of international law, which defines apartheid as a crime against humanity consisting of three primary elements, including an intent to maintain domination by one racial group over another, number two, a context of systematic oppression by the dominant group over the marginalized group, and number three, inhuman acts. The report found that the crime of apartheid is particularly severe in the OPT, where Palestinians live under draconian military rule, while the Zionist Jews live in a segregated manner in the same territory, yet enjoy full rights under Israeli civil law. According to the report, the Zionist regime's crimes of apartheid include a more than decade-long siege on Gaza, the severe restriction of movement of Palestinians in the OPT, the confiscation of more than a third of the land in the West Bank, policies and conditions in the West Bank that has led to forcible transfer of thousands of Palestinians, the denial of residency rights for Palestinians and their relatives in the OPT, and the continued denial of basic civil rights to millions of Palestinians. Across the land that the Zionist regime controls, the report highlighted, the Israeli regime's authorities have sought to maximize the land available for Jewish communities and to concentrate most Palestinians in dense population centers. Such policies, which explicitly label and treat Palestinians as a demographic threat, are most evident in places like Al-Quds, where the city's Israeli municipality has set the goal of maintaining a solid Jewish majority in the city and even specifies the demographic ratios it hopes to maintain, HRW noted. Such discriminatory policies that specifically target Palestinian communities and restrict their livelihoods, coupled with the reality that the state grants Israeli Jews the freedom to move about and live where they please, all contribute to the fake regime of Israel's crime of apartheid. These policies, which grant Jewish Israelis the same rights and privileges wherever they live and discriminate against Palestinians to varying degrees wherever they live, reflect a policy to privilege one people at the expense of another, HRW Executive Director Kenneth Roth said in a statement recently. Similar to its response toward Bethlehem report released in January, the Israeli regime wrote off the report as propaganda, with the Israeli regime's foreign ministry accusing HRW of demonizing Israeli regime. Human Rights Watch is known to have a long-standing anti-Israel agenda, actively seeking for years to promote boycotts against Israel, the foreign ministry said in a statement. The fake regime of Israel's foreign ministry went on to claim that HRW did not share the report for review or comment with the regime, a claim that HRW denies. The report stated that through the passage of bills like 2018 Nation State Law, which claimed that the right to exercise national self-determination in Israel is unique to the Jewish people, coupled with increased settlement expansion in recent years, has clarified Israel's intent to maintain the domination by Jewish Israelis. As a result, HRW recommended that individual nations and members of international community should take a number of steps into holding the fake regime of Israel accountable for its crimes against humanity and the crime of apartheid. In its recommendations, HRW suggests that its findings of crimes against humanity should prompt the international community to change its approach toward the Israeli regime and Palestine by moving away from the unending peace process and negotiations and move toward a human rights-based approach centered on accountability. While much of the world treats the Israeli regime's half-century occupation as a temporary situation that a decades-long peace process will soon cure, the oppression of Palestinians there has reached a threshold and performance that meets definitions of crimes of apartheid and persecution, Roth said. Among the group's recommendations are the following: an International Criminal Court, ICC investigation and prosecution of those credibly implicated in crimes against humanity and crimes of apartheid, the imposition of individual sanctions, including travel bans and asset freezes on individuals responsible for committing such crimes. Countries should establish a UN commission of inquiry to investigate systematic discrimination and repression in the occupied Palestine. Countries should establish a UN global envoy for the crimes of persecution and apartheid with a mandate to mobilize international action to end persecution and apartheid worldwide.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. Ask again and again. One of the required conditions for acceptance of dua is that we express them with attention. Sometimes, people might repeatedly say, with no real attention to the meaning, phrases like, O God, forgive us, O God, expand our share from your blessings, and O God, help us pay our debts. A person might say duas like that for 10 years, but their duas won't be accepted. You should supplicate to God and implore. You should beseech to God earnestly. Ask again and again. In this manner, God the Exalted will surely accept the duas and realize them. Teach us too. My advice is to practice self-observation during these 3 days spent in mosques. When you speak, when you eat, socialize, read, think, or plan for the future, always prefer God's satisfaction and will over your yearnings and desires. Do not surrender to your desires. Practicing these observances during the 3 days of itikaf can be a lesson for those dear ones performing it and for us sitting here, watching our dear young ones in itikaf. Teach us with your actions.
رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 ليتك دوما قريب
True awaiting. The most important responsibility of the individuals who await the coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is to improve spiritual, ethical and practical aspects and to establish religious and effective bonds with the believers and also get prepared for confronting the coercive people. Those who during the sacred defense era participated in the sacred defense enthusiastically were the ones who truly awaited Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. May God hasten his return. The person who is ready to defend the values, the Islamic homeland and the rising flag of Islam when the country is threatened by the enemies can claim that when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam comes, he would follow his steps in dangerous fields. But those who are weak in face of dangers, deviations, ups and downs of the world, those who won't do anything that would put their own interests at risk, can never be regarded as truly awaiting Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. A person who awaits that great Redeemer should prepare in themselves and the basis of redemption, and act in a manner so they can resist and redemption is realized.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Major financial institutions have announced that they have put more cryptocurrencies on their balance sheets as the price of a single Bitcoin, the world's most popular cryptocurrency, rocketed from around $20,000 in December to $65,000 earlier in April of 2021. On 26th of April, though, it traded around $53,000. We now present you an article written by Joseph Dana, the senior editor of Exponential View, a weekly newsletter about technology and its impact on society. The piece is titled "Face It, Cryptocurrencies Now Mainstream." The article has appeared on the front page of Syndication Bureau website. Please stay with us for more of Joseph Dana's article. Cryptocurrencies have had an amazing time this year. It's no longer a question of whether they can gain mainstream acceptance. We've long since passed that point. Driven by fears of inflation and easy-to-understand trading platforms, cryptocurrencies now are part and parcel of a changed global monetary system. The challenge is how governments and their regulators react. Which countries will appreciate the technology that enables cryptocurrencies, and how will they incorporate them into their financial system? And which will instead simply turn up their nose and pretend they don't exist? The way we store and record value has long reflected the nature of our economy and trading system. In ancient times, we bartered goods. Then we used precious metal coins to store and exchange value. The invention of paper money saw a further evolution in reflecting value backed by physical commodities, while fiat currency is a creation of the modern globalized financial system. Finally, in an age increasingly defined by digital technology, cryptocurrencies, of course, make imminent sense. There is no shortage of recent events contributing to the mainstream of cryptocurrencies this year. Coinbase, the largest crypto exchange in the United States, listed its shares on NASDAQ recently. Meanwhile, major financial institutions have announced that they have put more cryptocurrencies on their balance sheets, as the price of a single Bitcoin, the world's most popular cryptocurrency, rocketed from around $20,000 last December to $65,000 in April. On 26th of April, though, it traded around $53,000. Elon Musk's electric vehicle company Tesla bought roughly $1.5 billion worth of bitcoins and announced it will soon allow customers to purchase cars using that cryptocurrency. Dogecoin, which started as a joke based on a meme of a Shiba Inu dog, has gone up 8,100% this year. The total value of Dogecoins in circulation currently is around $50 billion, more than the market capitalization of the hospitality company Marriott, or Ford, the car maker. While Dogecoin and other cryptocurrencies have seen wild price swings recently, the reason for that volatility may in fact soon give rise to greater stability. The steep rise in prices has been because of more people and institutions investing in cryptocurrencies. But as more and more people and institutions become invested in cryptocurrencies, the more mature and stable cryptocurrencies become. Bitcoin has swung in the past month between about $50,000 and $65,000, a difference of 30% from the lower value. By any account, that is a massive price swing. But given the amount of institutional money pouring into Bitcoin, coupled with global interest, the price has been roughly stable within this range. Those who have watched Bitcoin evolve over the past 10 years would have expected much greater volatility. In fact, it is reasonable to expect the trading range eventually to narrow. Still, despite the rise in prominence of cryptocurrencies, there is no unified government approach towards cryptocurrencies. The administration of President Joe Biden in the United States claims it will introduce new regulations for cryptocurrencies, but it remains unclear what these new regulations will be. Meanwhile, China, which has strict laws regulating the use of cryptocurrencies, just announced it will launch its own digital currency. Built on similar technology as Bitcoin, the digital yuan could prove to be a model for governments worldwide. At the other end of the spectrum, India is mulling laws that will in effect ban cryptocurrencies altogether, part of a larger campaign to curtail the open internet. In short, government's response to cryptocurrencies is confused. On the other hand, financial markets are being stymied. Wall Street jumped on the cryptocurrency bandwagon this month, but it did so without actually trading any cryptocurrencies. For while participants in the United States markets have been hankering for an exchange-traded fund for cryptocurrencies, the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, still won't allow this. For all its virtues, Coinbase remains only a proxy. Its stock value is closely tied to the direction of prices of popular cryptocurrencies. One argument that cryptocurrency skeptics have used against coins like Bitcoin is that, at a practical level, they are too slow to trade. A transaction on the Bitcoin blockchain can take anywhere from 15 minutes up to an hour, depending on the volume of transactions. In the real world, though, no one is going to wait 15 minutes to pay for a cup of coffee. Such arguments are valid, but they fail to acknowledge the fact that cryptocurrency is a metacurrency. You store value in it, but you will likely still exchange it into dollars, dirhams, bahts, and so on to buy your coffee or to transfer funds. Let me provide a personal example. I regularly remit money from the United States to South Africa, where my wife and I live. In the past, it would require calling my American bank, paying hefty fees, and waiting a couple of days for the money to arrive in South Africa. Now I purchase stable cryptocurrencies that are pegged to the price of the US dollar and thus don't have price volatility like Bitcoin. There are many so-called stable coins. I use one called USD Coin. It takes a second to buy any amount of stable coins on my crypto exchange. Then I send them to my wife's crypto wallet in South Africa. The whole process takes just minutes, and the fees are normally less than $2. Moreover, I can do it all on my cell phone with a couple of taps. The recent announcement that the Canadian digital asset management firm 3IQ will list a Bitcoin fund on Nasdaq Dubai is another step in the right direction. First, it demonstrates that the United Arab Emirates is lowering its resistance to cryptocurrencies and embracing the technology for what it is, an integral part of the future of finance. Next, the Dubai listing follows the fund's listing on the Toronto Stock Exchange last year and may lead to other listings in places like Singapore, Taiwan, Sweden, and the United States, potentially allowing for 24-hour trading in the fund and thus greater price discovery. To paraphrase the Nobel laureate Bob Dylan, governments should get out of the way of cryptocurrencies if they can't lend a hand. For the times, they're truly a changing.
The debate.
In his first speech to Congress, U.S. President Joe Biden said, "We're in a competition with China and other countries to win the 21st century." The U.S. president said he's not seeking to worsen relations with Beijing and called diplomacy the best way to deal with disputes, but also said the U.S. will maintain a strong military presence in the Indo-Pacific. Beijing, for its part, has urged the U.S. to stop an upward trend in its military activities in the air and seas near China, which threatens regional peace. Joe Biden also said his country would stand up to China's unfair trade practices, accusing Beijing of intellectual property theft. Biden has maintained a tough anti-Beijing stance inherited from the previous administration, which also includes more visible support for Taiwan. This has infuriated China, which deems the island as part of its territory. The two countries are also locked in a years-long trade war. Well, joining us on tonight's debate, we have Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, Mr. John Pfeffer, who's joining us from Washington, D.C. Also, we have National Security Analyst Brian Downing joining us from Florida. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Pfeffer in Washington, D.C. On Wednesday, Joe Biden said that the U.S. was in a competition with China and other countries to win the 21st century. Please unpack that for us.
Well, the United States has for, well, a couple of decades identified China as kind of the leading challenger to its international global power in the world. And this has proven to be a kind of focal point for U.S. economic and strategic thinking. In other words, the United States is currently kind of reorienting its military away from the war on terror, the endless wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan, and toward great power competition, China being perhaps the most important of those competitors. But it's also economic, of course, as China has become, according to several standards, the most powerful economy in the world. And so this is something that the Biden administration, as you pointed out, has to a certain extent inherited from the Trump administration, but also from the Obama administration as well.
Mr. Downing, in Florida, Biden said that he doesn't want a conflict with the world's second largest economy, but the U.S. will stand up for its fundamental trade rights. China has frequently maintained that a U.S. military presence in the South China Sea, East China Sea, and Taiwan Strait is the main destabilizing factor in the region. Talk to us about the tensions under the new U.S. administration and who is threatening the stability of the region.
Well, you know, China is the rising economic power. It will be the most powerful economy in the world, and, you know, the estimates vary, but it's going to happen within 10 or 20 years. It's inevitable. And along with that growing sense of power, they want to show it symbolically, and historically one of the most important ways to do that has been through using your military, specifically your Navy, I think. You remember there was a time when the British Navy ranged from Europe through Caribbean, the Suez Canal, the Persian Gulf, Straits of Malacca, Hong Kong, everywhere. And then the United States, 100 years ago, Theodore Roosevelt sent the Great White Fleet around the world. It was a symbol that the United States was coming on and that Europe was a declining area. Well, China feels the same way towards the United States and wants to show it symbolically. I don't really think there's that much threat of an overt war between American and Chinese forces or even a major conflict. Remember, throughout the Cold War with the Soviet Union, we always heard, well, these incidents can get out of hand, and indeed they can. But through all that period, 1945 to 1991, things were pretty much held in check. There were hotlines, there were incidents. American and Russian naval vessels collided in the Mediterranean and elsewhere. So I really think it's a manageable thing. China, to my way of thinking, wants to dominate the world economically, establish its centricity in the world. Dominate might be too strong a word. Remember that in all recorded history, the Chinese economy has been the most powerful one in the world, except for two centuries, the 19th century and the 20th century. So to China, the West, the United States, these are historical aberrations that can and will be corrected in the next few decades. So I see it mostly as an economic conflict and not a military one. But as I said, incidents can happen.
Mr. Pfeffer, the Chinese Defense Ministry urged the United States on Thursday to rein in its frontline forces, which Beijing has said to have become more active in the air and seas near China this year. Why the increase in activity? What is the U.S. worried about?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, often at the beginning of administrations, whether we're talking about the Obama administration, the George W. Bush administration, there's heightened conflict with China initially as the two superpowers get a measure of one another. Often that has given way to a much more pragmatic relationship, to economic negotiations, even to some security negotiations. This time around, the Biden administration comes in at a time when it frankly has to focus on domestic issues. It has to revive the economy, has to get COVID under control. It is dealing with infrastructure needs. It has decided in large part to characterize those domestic transformations as equally necessary to combat a rise in China. In other words, we need infrastructure development in the United States to compete effectively with China. At the same time, we're responding to some of the initiatives under the Trump administration to draw together alliances more closely to contain China. This is kind of the flip side of Biden's approach to multilateralism. I mean, there are two approaches, obviously. One is to work with other countries to deal with global problems. The second is to work with your allies and some other countries to contain your adversaries. And it's this second type of multilateralism that the Biden administration has continued from the Trump years, for instance, coordinating with the so-called Quad, the United States, Japan, Australia, India, to discuss ways of combating Chinese influence, working more closely with Japan and South Korea in, you know, a greater trilateral cooperation, drawing closer with some of our allies around the South China Sea, particularly Vietnam in this case, military allies suddenly after 20 or 30 years of adversarial relations. All of it designed to push back at China and push back at what is perceived as greater assertiveness from the Chinese government, greater nationalism from the Chinese government. And so I think all of this combines to contribute to the United States giving signs through various methods, military methods, that it is not going to be falling back in the Pacific, that it will continue to assert itself as a Pacific power.
Mr. Downing, responding to a question about Biden's speech, a spokesman for China's foreign ministry said the U.S. was merely feeling insecure and jealous about China's development. Those comments were made by Wang Wenbin. He said at a daily briefing that this is in nature out of Cold War thinking, a zero-sum mindset, an ideological bias, and a sign of lack of confidence. Do you see it in that light as well?
I think there is, over the last few years, a sense of insecurity and resentment in the United States. That's something that just about every American knew for the last 75 years or so, that the United States was the dominant power in the world, is very much in doubt. And there are insecurities, resentments, and anxieties associated with that. But, you know, let's bear in mind that Chinese airplanes go fly over Taiwan airspace every day. They may be doing it right now while we're doing this interview. Their ships violate territorial waters of the Philippines, Vietnam, and other countries. So, you know, it's not as though China is just sitting back and building its economy and not doing anything to cause anxieties, fears, and concerns.
Okay, Mr. Pfeffer, China warned the U.S. against meddling in its internal affairs and threatened firm actions against U.S. interference in issues like Hong Kong and, of course, Taiwan, considering the congestion of forces in, above, and below the Taiwan Straits and the South China Sea. A conflict could explode by accident or even by design. Is a serious escalation over Taiwan imminent, in your opinion?
Well, I think I would agree with Brian that there's really not an imminent chance of military conflict between the United States and China. That both sides are eager to avoid any kind of significant escalation. As I said, the Biden administration wants to focus on rebuilding the United U.S. economy. China, of course, is focused also on not just economic progress within China, recovering obviously from the COVID crisis, but also building its One Belt, One Road initiative throughout the world. But at the same time, there's always a chance of unexpected escalation. This has been a threat now for a couple of decades, really. Expectation that some miscalculation in the Taiwan Strait or in the South China Sea will lead to an escalation. We've seen incidents in the past, whether it was the downing of a U.S. plane by the Chinese during the George W. Bush administration, or more recently, Chinese moves in Xinjiang province, Hong Kong, domestically within their own country that have, that the United States has strenuously protested against. Any of these could escalate, move out of control, grow out of control. But I don't think it's imminent. As I said, you know, there really aren't not a lot of actors, even in the region, that are eager to see any such crisis take place. You know, there's Japan, South Korea, even the Philippines, Vietnam, whatever anger they might have over Chinese moves, they are not eager to have a full-fledged war at this point.
All right, Mr. Downing, you addressed this question earlier. Allow me to rephrase it. Is the U.S. willing to risk a serious escalation with Beijing when it comes to Taiwan?
Well, the question sort of presupposes some sort of hostile action by China towards Taiwan. As I said, they're flying planes over, but, you know, Russia's flying planes over Alaska, probably, as we're taping, doing this interview. You know, Taiwan is a very big island. It has a strong military. The place is well defended. If the Chinese attacked it, I don't know that China would win. Their navy would be highly vulnerable in the Taiwan Straits for several months as a ground campaign unwound. And they could take a beating from ship-killing missiles that Taiwan has, the United States, Japan, lots of people. The analogy I made in an article was the Battle of Okinawa during 1945, where an American fleet was outside of Okinawa, a pretty small island about 100 miles south of the Japanese mainland. And the United States, I don't have the numbers at hand, but I think the United States lost about 150 ships sunk or put out of action by the Japanese armed forces, mainly the famous kamikaze planes. If China did somehow take Taiwan or try to, I think the United States, the Quad that Mr. Pfeffer referred to, could cut off oil from the Persian Gulf very easily. Look at all the American military bases in the Persian Gulf. They could close it off in a matter of 24, 36 hours. There's nothing China could do there. If they send any ships to hostile action, they'd be sunk in a matter of hours. Furthermore, if China did do that, it's highly likely that South Korea and other countries would go nuclear. They are already nuclear, pretty much nuclear powers. They have the fissionable material. They have the warhead capacity. They have the missile systems. They're what's called a latent nuclear power. And I don't think China wants that. You know, something that could happen, there are a few islands owned by Taiwan that are maybe 5 or 6 miles, 10 kilometers off the Chinese coast. Kemoi Matsu, they're called the Tianmen Islands, I believe. Do a web search for those pictures. You'll see these islands with big fortifications and clearly visible in the background. You can see Chinese skyscrapers. So I think something we could see is for China to take those islands. They're utterly indefensible.
Mr. Pfeffer, let's look at this from another perspective. What is China's main priority in its relations with Washington?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think China has a number of priorities. The first, of course, is, as the spokesperson said, the United States should stop interfering in what China considers to be its sovereign territory, that China should, you know, that China just wants to do whatever it wants to do within its own borders without having to deal with certainly the criticisms of other countries, but also other forms of interference. So I think that's number one, and China has pursued a non-interference policy for decades. When it comes to the economy, you know, the Chinese would like to have, you know, free rein in terms of their actions around the world. They don't want to encounter any kinds of sanctions or additional tariffs or any other barriers to investment. when they're looking towards, for instance, extracting raw materials from other countries or setting up various types of infrastructure projects. So that's number two. I mean, they definitely want to be able to get along, more or less, with the United States economically. The overlap with U.S. Interests comes to a point with environmental issues. China has done a pretty good job of addressing climate change issues or reducing carbon emissions within its own borders, closing coal-fired plants, for instance. It hasn't done such a good job in terms of encouraging that through its One Belt, One Road initiatives, through its infrastructure development projects, in part because they've been exporting some of the same kind of dirty energy projects abroad that they've been winding down domestically. But here's a possibility for overlap with the United States, and that is during the Obama administration, Beijing and Washington worked together on developing clean energy technologies through the Clean Energy Research Consortium. And that's still ongoing. It kind of fell under the radar, fell off the radar during the Trump administration, but it's still ongoing. It's conceivable that China and the United States could find greater common ground on such kinds of clean energy cooperation, research and development. So that's a third kind of priority.
Sure.
That we could see in U.S. China relations.
Yeah, we're running short of time. Allow me to get one last question in for Mr. Downing. Very briefly, if you may, Mr. Downing, what happens? We've already seen the Biden administration's approach to China. It's been very hostile and antagonizing. What happens if China takes a no-compromise approach towards the U.S.?
I'm going to have to ask you to spell that out, what that non-compromising position would be. I don't know whether they're going to cut off American products from being sold in China. Two can play that game. Are they going to stop investing in the United States? That would be a pretty serious blow. I think what China wants to do is become the dominant investing power in the world. Second, it wants to be the dominant market in the world. If you want to sell your products in China, well, we're going to have some sort of political comedy there. Third, I think China wants to control natural resources, iron, copper, specifically rare earths.